From Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. On today's episode, we hear from Gary Ross on his new film, Free State of Jones, and his career in storytelling for the screen.
We fell into something that I did not know how to do. And here's an interesting lesson for everyone. I actually told the studio I knew how to do it and was shooting and still didn't.
And later in our program, Academy Award winner Steve Zaillian discusses his work from The Falcon and the Snowman to Schindler's List to American Gangster.
I want to discover something. Awakenings, it was medicine. I don't know anything about medicine. The chess world, gangsters in the 1970s in New York, Harlem. I don't know anything about that. I would be bored writing about something that I know a lot about.
On Story will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. Free State of Jones is the new film from writer-director Gary Ross. The film is inspired by events surrounding an armed rebellion against the Confederacy in Mississippi during the American Civil War. Free State of Jones stars Matthew McConaughey, Gugu Mbatha-Raw, Mahershala Ali, Kerry Russell, and Brendan Gleeson. We recently spoke with Gary Ross over the phone about his new film.
I found this story the way many people had, sort of the bare bones of Newt Knight and his rebellion. I think there'd been three or four books written on it at that point. It's not entirely unknown, but obviously it's not famous either. And so I was very intrigued with the idea that there was this Unionist rebellion within the Confederacy, because at the time, I mean, I've since obviously studied it a lot, but at the time, I didn't really know that much about the Civil War and very, very little about Reconstruction, the period after, which I studied quite a lot of now. So I just found it fascinating. You know, we're all raised with the idea that the Civil War was North versus South and that it was monolithic, that it was sort of the Confederacy was one single entity and unanimous, when in fact it wasn't. There was a great deal of dissent in the South and Southern Unionism, and people that opposed the slaveholding class and people that opposed slavery. It's just that a lot of that has been sort of lost to history or rewritten over time. And so I found that fascinating. And that led me, as you mentioned, to a very long period of study before I ever even wrote the script. I joked that it was kind of like my academic midlife crisis, because I didn't really do anything except read and study with wonderful historians. And that was a very, very exciting time for me. And we uncovered a lot of primary source information and research that hadn't been known to that point. In fact, we're going to be putting up a website that footnotes the entire movie and shares our primary sources and our footnotes and shows what all of this is based on factually. So that's kind of exciting. But I really didn't know a lot about that. But in order to understand what had happened, you had to understand a much broader context of the Civil War and Reconstruction. And so I studied first, obviously, Vicki Bynum, who I believe is a Texan and lives very near you, who wrote the first academic examination of Newt Knight. Really good book, The Free State of Jones. And then I just began to study with a lot of other people, historians, to sort of fill in the context and understand it more fully. David Blight, Stephen Hahn, won a Pulitzer Prize for A Nation Under Our Feet. And then I finally found my way to a guy named John Stauffer at Harvard, with whom I studied more formally for a couple of years as a visiting fellow there. So it really was a long period of time that I just read before ever even beginning to attempt the movie. In any movie, you're kind of obligated to fill in the areas that we don't have a written record of. And in Newt's case, he's not a president or a general or a king. He's a common yeoman farmer who led a rebellion. So there isn't much written record, although we do have a lot of record about the incidents themselves. He didn't leave a first-person record, let me put it that way. And so we're forced to extrapolate, and we're forced to fill these things in, and of course we're forced to fictionalize, and that's the job of movies. But even when we do so, we base it on a great deal of source material and fact, what was typical for the era, what was true in the era. We don't just make something up out of whole cloth. It may not be literally, incidentally specific to Newt Knight, but it's always, always reliably based on primary source material and factual information. So the way I kind of look at it as a filmmaker is that there's times where you have to fictionalize and use your skills as an artist, your interpretive skills, as it were, to tell a deeper truth. A good example is the character of Moses. I hesitate to call him a fictional character, although he technically is, because he's an amalgam of so many different characters that I encountered in my research on the era. He's very typical of the Freedmen's experience through Reconstruction, which was a tremendously important thing to chronicle. What that struggle for freedom was, how freedom was demanded, it wasn't just granted. What the struggle for the franchise and voting rights were, how African Americans had to struggle for their freedom even after that war was over. And it would have been an omission not to include that in this movie. And so it's absolutely a part of the narrative. Even if it's not based on a specific person, it's based on many. I think Newt was technically controversial because he was very anti-Confederate, and that obviously engenders a strong reaction in a lot of people. But I don't think there's much controversy as to his rebellion either existing or what it was about. There's voluminous information and evidence in the official record of the war between the states, which is the most reliable source of information that all scholars use. And there's primary source information in terms of correspondence between Confederate officers talking about him. This isn't like relying on some family history or something like that. There are letters that go all the way up to Polk. There's a letter to Jefferson Davis. I mean, the Newt Knight Rebellion is referred to specifically in a lot of primary source material, all of which we'll also be referencing and putting up online. So the fact that that rebellion existed, the fact that it was a yeoman rebellion, it was a class-based rebellion against the planter class on the part of yeoman farmers who did not want to fight for slavery or the slaveholding elites. I think all that's just very clearly established and isn't controversial. The way you may feel about Newt is certainly controversial. Whether or not this happened, I think the record can set that controversy to rest. I really loved learning about this and getting to work with the greatest historians in the world, which is a privilege, I suppose, when you get to make a movie. I've been on this for 10 years now, and you know, I've read thousands and thousands of pages and dozens of books, and greatest experience of my life. I'm ready to tackle something else. You know, I think variety is a healthy thing when you're a filmmaker.
Writer-director Gary Ross on his latest film, Free State of Jones, in theaters June 24th. Ross is a four-time Academy Award nominee, and his other film credits include Big, Pleasantville, Seabiscuit, and The Hunger Games, which he co-wrote and directed. Barbara Morgan spoke with Gary Ross at the 22nd Austin Film Festival in 2015.
Thank you for coming to see Gary Ross. He had sort of a Planes, Trains, and Automobiles experience getting here last night. And already the story has turned legendary. In the staff meeting this morning, I heard he flew into a cornfield to get here last night in time for his Q&A for Pleasantville. So whether that's true or not, I don't know. Sounds great. It's a great story. And we're going to
true
keep...
now.
That's right. This is a storytellers festival, so we're going to keep that one. I want to tell a quick story about the last time that Mr. Ross was here. It was 1998. Pleasantville was just about to come out. We were 5 years old.
First time it had been shown in public.
Yes, it was the premiere, public premiere. It was at the Paramount Theater. There was about 1,100 people that fit in there, and we were completely sold out. And the projection broke down at least five times.
Then it broke down at a specific moment in reel nine, because we were on 1,000-foot reels. And I remember, because I'd introduced the movie, coming in to sort of, I didn't know what I was going to do, sort of like play spoons or dance or something like that, to entertain people. And as I walked up the lobby of the theater, this guy stood up, was cap-esque, and screamed, "This is a great frickin' movie!" And then I got a standing ovation in the middle of the movie, which, I mean, it's so much better than the thing not breaking. Like, I would have, you know. Probably, honestly, the high point of my career to this date. So.
Well, anyway, so when Aaron told me that not only was he coming back, but he wanted to show Pleasantville, I was like, hives, shingles,
I wanted
everything.
To get through it once, but I didn't get to see it last night because of the rain. I literally got here as the credits were over. So I missed it, yeah.
But I'll
catch it on DVD, I don't know.
But your persistence in getting here is appreciated.
Thank you, yeah.
So anyway, we're thrilled to have him back. Wanted to first start out talking about Big and how you made the decision to become a screenwriter and where that idea came from and how that whole project happened
for
you.
Well, those are sort of two different things. I was a novelist making no money, starving, and I got a job with a friend of mine writing a thing for Paramount where I was getting paid as much for a 15-page treatment as it was for my entire novel. So it probably suited me better. I grew up in the film medium. I had studied acting with Stella Adler. I directed plays in college. I'd lived in a theater community. So it was something that was just natural to me. And I think a natural migration. But then I had this idea, I won't belabor how, but I did have this idea for Big. I shared it with my neighbor, Ann Spielberg, with whom I ended up writing Big. And we had this sort of electric, spontaneous jam session around the idea of the movie where we outlined, I would say, 80% of the movie. In fact, I just signed someone's poster for me and Ann out there. But yeah, it was this very kind of quick, spontaneous, combustible thing where we literally came up with this. Because fables will do that too, you know. Unlike other forms of outlining, they're so whole and classical, they sort of suggest the structure as you're doing it, right? So it happened quickly, and I'm not hawking DVDs, but if there's like a 20th anniversary where we actually play the tape that Anne made of that session, and you hear us come up with the whole movie live. And it was just the easiest thing I ever did. Dave was the hardest thing I ever did, because the reality had to be ginned up. That was my second movie. But my first movie was just so whole and organic, and I had a partner, and we were having fun. If you have a good partner, I really recommend it. You know, your early 20s can be so lonely, and it was so nice to have somebody to work with every day. You know, and she was my buddy and lived down the block, and then we were working on these assignments. We ended up having adjoining offices at Universal just by chance, and so this thing developed. I heard this story about how Ernest Lehman and Alfred Hitchcock came up with North by Northwest because they hated what they were writing. They were writing something about a shipwreck, and they hated it so much that their diversion was to come up with North by Northwest.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they just made up their shit every day about, like, oh, then there's a plane, and somebody stabbed in the UN, and it was so much fun for them that it was like their little dessert. It was their vacation from this drudgery they had to do. And, of course, work should never be drudgery, but that's what Big felt like. It felt like this fun thing that didn't feel like work. It felt like unwork. And because of that, there was a great empowering feeling in it. Aspiration and all that, I think I knew how successful it could be, but also just, it was a pleasure.
So that was just sort of a magic project to start with.
Yeah, and it also afforded me the first of two real apprenticeships to become a director by being there every day and being around the process and seeing my stuff go from, you know, word to screen. You know, it allowed me to apprentice in a way that I think is indispensable because I didn't go to film school.
Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, screenwriting software with over 100 templates that format and paginate screenplays, teleplays, and stage plays. More information at finaldraft.com. On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International will be back in a moment.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. We're back with filmmaker Gary Ross speaking with Barbara Morgan at the 22nd Austin Film Festival in 2015.
So how did that lead to the next project?
Well, the next project, which was Dave, which I love, it was so hard. It was this terrible idea for a movie, I thought, which was this look-alike looks like the president. And they swap him out in a prisoner. It's not original. I mean, they swap him out in a prisoner of Zenda, Prince and the Pauper kind of way, you know. And I loved American politics and had grown up around it, you know, and all of that. And so I was enthralled by this idea. But it's a really cheesy idea. And the challenge was, okay, how do I find something in that that matches my taste in an idea where 99 times out of 100 it won't and could be awful? And so it was brutally difficult to write. Normally in these like high concept movies, there's one suspension of disbelief and everything is just inevitable after that, right? But in Dave, because you're familiar with the language of politics because you see it on television or whatever, I had to keep ginning up the reality and sustaining the reality and making it feel real in every moment. And I did that through the use of real people. And Ivan Reitman, who I ended up being close with, he said, yeah, well, you'll never get these people, but go ahead. And I just knew it was essential that we get them or the movie. Nobody at that point used real people in a movie playing themselves to that degree. It had just never happened before, this idea. And I had recently read In Cold Blood, and I was sort of intrigued with the idea of that borderline between fact and fiction. And I thought, this is an interesting, in a lighthearted, comedic way, to pierce that fourth wall. So I got business cards printed up that said Warner Brothers on them, and I went to the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and I went to every reporter I could recognize, and I just started handing them my business card saying, do you want to be in a movie? And to a person, they all said yes, but I'm not sure my network will let me. Literally, no one turned me down. And it was pure fantasy camp for me because these were all people I'd seen on CNN and all this stuff. So we ended up getting like six senators and Tip O'Neill, Speaker of the House, and every reporter you'd ever heard of. And I mean, at the end of that movie is a crawl of all those things. But probably the biggest story about it is that it was such a hard movie to write and to sustain. And the Capra-esque thing has so many kind of earnest quagmires that you can step in if you're not clear, that I wrote a really bad draft. And I knew it was bad because I was on page 150 and climbing, and I'd left out a middle thing, and the end wasn't in sight, and I knew I was meandering, that feeling where you're not being pulled, you're sort of pushing. And it just wasn't going well. And then I went to the dentist, and I was on nitrous oxide. And I had this kind of drug-induced vision, this sweat lodge moment that I had completely screwed up the movie. And then when the drugs were off, I realized it was true. I had screwed up the movie, and it was not a hallucination. So I went back to my wife, and I said, I really think I need to start from scratch because this isn't working. And so we took out a second mortgage on our house. You know, I was young and scared and all that stuff, but I kind of knew that if I ended up writing the movie that I was happy with and people didn't like it, well, I could live with myself. But if I ended up writing a movie that I wasn't happy with and they didn't like it, I couldn't live with myself. So I just said, the hell with that, and I'm going to keep writing what I want to write. And it turned out okay, so.
So let's go to Seabiscuit. That's such a beloved film, clearly, right? Based on a beloved book about a beloved horse. So how did you decide to take that on and take something that's sort of in everybody's psyche in that way?
I found it in a magazine article, and I thought that there's sort of a populist element that no sports story can really be about sports. It has to be, sports have to be about something larger. It had all those elements, and I bought the magazine, or got Universal to buy the magazine rights to this thing, and then we bought the book rights based on what Laura was going to turn into. What I found in it, adaptation-wise, was the idea that these people were kind to each other, that they healed each other through kindness. In a cynical modern world that embraces edge, that's actually a very high bar to be able to make a movie out of, mm-hmm. where the tension is between people and themselves and their own obstacle, and the conflict comes from their own ability to recognize that within one another embrace that in each other and lift each other up, that a movie about kindness may be the hardest thing you can possibly write. So I think I was intrigued by the degree of difficulty. Yeah. Thematically, it was a nuclear family coming together that was unlikely. So it was not a celebration of a horse. It was about broken people in the Depression. And that, I thought, was an interesting thing. I'm obviously a history buff, so that was an interesting thing to write about. And then directorially, it was just a massive, difficult canvas. But so had Pleasantville been. You know, I've never really chosen to direct something that is just people talking in a room, because I like to be challenged or interested.
Well, I mean, that's from a screenwriting perspective, which I want to talk about for a little bit here, is or I want you to talk about, is a couple of things that I found so fascinating about Seabiscuit. Were, one, the way you braided, and it really felt braided, the stories of these people together, that is a difficult thing to do, and how you chose to do it the way you did, and why you waited so long to introduce the title character.
Well,
because
it wasn't about the horse, right. You know. I mean, it was about them. Mm-hmm. And also, there's a bit of a defiant bust the paradigm thing in me a little bit, and I thought, oh, it's cool, I'm going to bring the horse in on page 45, uh-huh. You know. But it was about these guys, and to me, the movie was about lost souls wandering, finding one another. Well, you can't do that without the wandering period and without the finding period. And so that took 45 pages, then it did. And the horse was only the catalyst to bring them together. And unless you understood their journeys and their isolation and their longings and what they were going through, that moment is just like finding a racehorse. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could find that at the Keeneland auctions. You know, you don't need a... Right. So to me, that wasn't really the point. Mm-hmm. It's a very kind of transitory experience if all you're doing is rooting for an athlete to win something. The experience evaporates when you leave the theater. So I can make you invested in anything, even in a 60-second commercial, but that's not really the issue.
Well, and this may be an unanswerable question, but I think one of the things that I really enjoyed about that film is the isolation of those characters and the profound sadness of those characters. It was almost poetic, and how you approached that as a writer, because is that a conscious decision when you were writing?
Yeah, it was. It's a little, yeah, it was. That even in the little actions, that movie had a very imbued kind of poetic lens on them. I don't know I'd shoot it the same way now. It's interesting. But it did have that, an almost elegiac quality all the way through, a mythic kind of thing. You know, yes, I was conscious in the script and in the execution.
Yeah, and that scene, I mean, just the scene where Red is on the horse at night riding around, to me was just an incredibly impactful.
That came out of a personal experience, actually. It's like 23, 24 years old. I was in Baja, California. I was with my friend Eric Montgomery. I used to ride horses a lot. And there was a road that had large manzanita bushes on either side, but perfectly packed dirt, and was straight, like dead straight and flat along the sea for probably 10 miles, you know. And we went out riding, and then we're coming back, and we're galloping these horses, and it was dusk, and then soon it was twilight, and then soon it was dark. And then I realized the horse could see, but I couldn't. So there was this crazy act of trust that happened with this, like, warm wind on you, galloping this horse. You can barely see. You know he can see. It was one of, to this day, the most exhilarating feelings of my life, just, like, galloping this horse into this headwind as the detail in front of you disappeared on what was a really dark and moonless night with just, like, hot wind and, like, do I dare to keep going? Like, what's out there, right? So that was, like, the most profound, safe horse experience I'd had. I'd ridden since I was little, but that was crazy. And so I decided to put it in the movie.
Okay, so now we'll talk about Pleasantville. Will you talk a little bit about where that idea came from and where you were in your life at that point? And
oh, I talked about this last night a little bit. I was writing something that was not going well. It was a drama. I was writing for Universal. I was very tense. It was a little rigid while I was writing it. It was coming off of Dave. I wanted to do a drama, but it wasn't really clear on the protagonist or the intentions. And then I realized, well, this didn't work out, and I went to Universal. They were very angry at this, and I said, I'm giving you back the money, but I'm not turning in the script. And they were enraged at the time that a writer would just say, nope, didn't work, here's your money back.
How did your agent take that?
I didn't really care. And so I gave that back. And then I was in Paris and jet lagged. And I'd written Pleasantville as a half-hour TV pilot. And so there was just the beginnings of, like, the early stirrings of the first act. It wasn't really anything that you've seen up here. It just had some things that were similar. And then I started outlining it and outlining it, and these ideas came. And it was sort of an act of freedom because I felt liberated to just hypothesize and imagine. And the other experience had been the opposite. I felt very tense and cut off in the other experience. And in Pleasantville, I just felt kind of free and inventive. And I was jet lagged, so I was waking up at 4 a.m. and taking 3 or 4 hours every night to just spin stuff out on legal pads. And then I thought, well, it shouldn't be, remember it began in TV, like the medium and about the medium.
Right.
And I called my friend Steven Soderbergh, and I said, who had always loved the thing, and I said, you know what, I think this is more kind of like a bizarre, buoyant, dystopian drama with satire, essentially. It's more Alice in Wonderland than anything else, and I think it could be a miniseries. Why don't you direct one half, and I'll direct the other half? And Soderbergh said, great. And so I started doing it and outlining more, and the more I began outlining, more I realized, no, this is just a really good movie that I want to express. And so I called Steven, and I said, well, okay, good news is I think it's a movie. Bad news is I want to direct it. Why don't you produce it? He said, great. And then that was the genesis of it.
So what were you, I mean, did you have an intent of trying to say something with that script? Or was it really coming out of free consciousness? And what were you trying to say then, and what do you feel like it says now?
Well, I don't think there's a distinction between coming out of consciousness and saying something. I mean, I think that unless you're writing cynically, you're always saying something. What you're saying doesn't have to add up to something formulaic or tidy, right? But you're still expressing yourself as an artist, and it's still saying something. And obviously, that's not a movie that's just about pure entertainment. I mean, it's got some stuff in its mind. I don't think it, someone said, asked me last night, is it a feminist statement? Is it a statement about race? Is it a statement about values? Is it a statement about freedom versus repression? And I don't think it's a statement. I think it's an examination of a lot of things. It's an examination of the struggle that we all feel inside us between those things we repress and those things we accept. It's about leaving the Garden of Eden. It's an Edenic biblical allegory, is what it actually is. It is the book of Genesis, only I'm not necessarily telling it in the way it was originally told. That rather than being expelled from the garden, they recreate the garden and accept that garden, snake, apple, and all.
So when you were making the decision to do some of the very unique things you did in the visualization of that film, can you talk about like how did you envision this in your head? And
well, I thought it was more possible than it was. I didn't understand that colorizing that much and putting certain things in color, certain things not in color, was at that point a really difficult thing to do. Involved a tremendous amount of roto. It involved frame-by-frame coloring. No one had ever done this before. They'd colorized movies, but they'd grabbed what's called luminance mats and just kind of grossly colorized them, but at a much lower level of resolution, 540 lines versus 2,000. No one had done this, a fully digital movie, before. So I inadvertently, with my team, invented what's called the digital intermediate. It was the first movie that ever had one. Now, every movie does a DI, but we were the first to do that on rented Macs in my office. And then the Coen brothers called me through T-Bone Burnett a short time later when they were doing A Brother and said, we want to do a bleach bypass process, but we understood that you did this other thing. And I said, yeah, I scanned the whole movie and manipulated it in a computer and then went back to film. And they said, oh, that sounds like cool. So then they did that for A Brother, and then that story of their digital bleach bypass caught on, and then people started doing DIs after that. But yeah, we fell into something that I did not know how to do. And here's an interesting lesson for everyone. I actually told the studio I knew how to do it and was shooting and still didn't. So each part of the process has to have its own spontaneity in life, but particularly bravery. It's a medium that is completely about bravery, almost whistling in the graveyard in a sense, that you need to be able to just sort of not cling to the previous step. And it doesn't mean bravery in terms of your bosses or the public or reviewers or anything like that. It means personal bravery to, like, not be freaked, look at the thing, and be inventive and calm and open enough to be inventive and have a little bit of a chuckle that you just jumped out of the plane.
How much has each directing project changed your writing process as a screenwriter?
I think I write more now that way so as not to feel the metronome, even in the screenwriting process, that there's times it accelerates, there's times it slows down, there's times it pauses for that kind of observed scene, there's times that a lot of scenes over a larger period of time add up to a section in the movie. So I think it has evolved in that way.
Support for On Story comes from Loyola Marymount University School of Film and Television, ranked a top 5 film school by USA Today, offering graduate degrees in screenwriting, production, and writing and producing for TV. Visit sftv.lmu.edu.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. Academy Award-winning filmmaker Steven Zaillian's vast filmography includes the screenplays to The Falcon and the Snowman, Awakenings, Schindler's List, and Moneyball. He wrote and directed Searching for Bobby Fischer, A Civil Action, and All the King's Men, and he wrote and produced American Gangster and the American version of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Steven Zaillian received the Distinguished Screenwriter Award at the 16th Austin Film Festival in 2009, where filmmaker and journalist Sasha Gervaisi moderated this conversation.
Obviously, everyone's aware of all the incredible scripts that you've written and films that you've made, but let's start a bit at the beginning. Was there a particular moment where, for you, you decided or realized you were going to become a writer?
I didn't study writing. When I got out of college, I kind of stumbled into a job as an assistant editor, film editor. And while I was doing that, I met some actors who were in the films that I was working on, and we decided to try to make a film together. Somebody had to write it. I took a crack at it. I didn't really know what I was doing, and my brain didn't really think in terms of screenplay form, so I wrote it as a novel, but with the idea of it becoming a screenplay at some point.
And that was that Bad Manners? So Bad Manners, this was a big deal. Steve tells the story of being in Barney's Beanery in West Hollywood and getting the call from his agent, Harold, that he had made his first professional sale, which at the time I think was about 1980.
It wasn't on a cell phone either.
Oh, it was on a payphone, of course. 1981, too? Suddenly you're a professional writer. Was that a shock to the system, or was that just the next
step? I didn't really think of it that way. I mean, I thought of it as someone who had written a script that had sold, but that I wasn't really a writer. Right. I didn't call myself a writer until I'd written maybe 5 scripts and sold them. I didn't think it would last. I thought I would, it was kind of a one-shot deal. Well, it just goes to show you how accidental a lot of things are in life. After I sold this first screenplay, which, by the way, was never made, I got hired to write another script, and it was an adaptation of the book Alive, which eventually was made into a movie, but not with my script. That was fateful for a couple of reasons, not the script itself, but because the assistant to this producer was a young guy named Scott Rudin. He was about 18 years old. So I met him at the very beginning, and we've worked together a number of times since then. John Schlesinger had tried to make Alive a number of years before. So when someone gave him my script as a writing sample, he was familiar with the project, he was familiar with the book, he could tell what I had done in the adaptation in a way that somebody else who wasn't familiar wouldn't be able to. So having all that knowledge, he liked what I had done.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International. We'll be back in a moment.
Thank you.
Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, screenwriting software with over 100 templates that format and paginate screenplays, teleplays, and stage plays. More information at finaldraft.com. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. We're back with Academy Award winner Steven Zaillian speaking with filmmaker and journalist Sasha Gervaisi at the 16th Austin Film Festival.
Let's talk about Falcon and the Snowman. I mean, how was the experience being in Mexico on the set with John Schlesinger? I mean, obviously he was incredibly inclusive, which is not necessarily typical. But what did that feel like, you know, when your first scene rolled and you had incredible actors like Sean running your lines? How was that experience?
John, you know, came from the English stage. So his way of thinking about writers is different than the way Hollywood directors think of them. The writer is a crucial part of the process to him. He likes talking about scripts. He likes having them on the set. So that was very unusual. The fact that my first script had actors like this in it was very unusual too. And you know, sometimes things have happened in my life where I didn't really realize how special they were until years later, but I knew that this was special. Mm-hmm. So I enjoyed every minute of it. It was great being in Mexico. It was crazy. My wife, who wasn't my wife at the time, was working on the film as well. So, I mean, it was just special for a lot of reasons.
And apparently Tim Hutton modeled himself on you. For those who have seen the film, Tom Hutton wears a brown leather jacket and cowboy boots, which essentially he took Steve's look and studied him, apparently, as legend goes. But moving on now, so this was like a fairly significant event in the life of a professional writer, an incredible director, incredible set of actors. Again, setting the tone for what was to become, your hallmark, doing these incredibly dramatic, true stories, essentially, adaptations of fairly momentous events in cases. And when you're writing a script, do you have to sort of put that out of your mind, or is there a moral complexity about how someone's going to be portrayed? Do you feel a duty to that person versus the story? How do you navigate through that, if you do?
I've done it a lot, and I would say that everyone responds differently. I mean, sometimes who I'm writing about likes it and some people don't. I do have a sense of responsibility to them. I have a kind of code, you know, that I follow in terms of how much license I can take and how much I can't. When we were doing the disclaimer for Falcon and the Snowman, I was unhappy with the way it read, which was basically, nothing you see in this movie is true. You know, those kind of disclaimers.
Right.
And I guess it's a disclaimer so they don't get sued. But there was a lawyer who was working for Orion, and I told him I didn't really like what it said, even though I know nobody reads it. I mean, it's a block of, you know, stuff at the end of the film. And he rewrote it. I think it might be the only film that this is in. And it says, certain scenes have been created for dramatic clarity.
Clarity, that's good.
And right. I like that because I felt that is true. I'm not doing it to make it just dramatic. I'm actually doing it to clarify it.
I wanted to go back a little bit into your background because for those who don't know, Steve's father was a fairly renowned radio journalist, quite a serious journalist. And I wondered, growing up in that household, to what degree did that inform the way you approach things in your work? Because it seems there's definitely a parallel between the two of you.
Well, he influenced me in many ways, apart from what he did for a living. I mean, just in terms of his morality, he was working as a reporter for many years, and then he got a job as a radio documentary maker. He would edit the stuff at home, and when I say edit, I mean taking quarter-inch tape and, you know, with a razor blade. So I would kind of hear his documentaries playing over and over and over as he was editing them. Did it influence me? I don't know. It made me comfortable with the idea of telling real-life stories.
But you did become an editor yourself. I mean, you became
That's true.
A film editor.
Yeah,
so there is
with
a,
razor blades, yeah.
There is a connection. Going back to that very briefly, the relationship between editing and screenwriting, because I imagine those skills might be somewhat parallel in terms of what were some of the lessons that might have been applicable that came from editing a film to writing a script?
Well, first of all, should we talk about the films I edited?
Let's talk about a film Okay, ladies and gentlemen, Kingdom of the Spiders. Let's discuss that. Please look it up. Kingdom of the Spiders, Schindler's List, he has range. I think it's fair to say that you did work on some, I think it was a Chuck Norris film, wasn't it? Chuck Norris film.
First Chuck Norris
film. The first Chuck Norris film.
How have I applied that?
How have you applied that to Schindler's List? No. But what were those skills? Because it does seem to me, in terms of storytelling, in terms of the way that you write, what I've observed in some of your scripts is you get into your scene as late as possible and you get out as early as you can. Yeah. It's incredibly concentrated and focused, the scenes. There's not a lot of fat. And I wonder whether that was something that came from editing.
I think it may have, at least part of it.
Right.
The thing that happened, I think, more than that was to get into the movie as late as possible and to get out as soon as possible. Not just in a scene, but in the whole movie.
Right.
I think that a mistake that a lot of people make, I read these scripts all the time, is that, you know, the writer isn't exactly sure who the character is, so they're experimenting with, okay, what does the character gets up in the morning? What does the character do? You know, they're starting at the very beginning of the day and as far back into the character's life as they need to go in order to understand the character. At some point editing, I realized with most things I was working on, you could take out the first reel, just throw it away at the first 10 minutes and start the movie where the action starts and get to know the character over the course of the real action, not as a kind of preamble.
So after The Falcon and the Snowman, how did it arise that you were going to come to do, Awakenings? And was there a direct connection?
Walter Parks called me up, and he had the rights to a little book called Awakenings, which was Dr. Oliver Sacks's memoirs, or at least memoirs of a certain period in his life. And I was fascinated by it. It was a book of research. It had no story, but it had the research and it had the facts. One section was case histories of the patients. The second half was kind of a philosophical examination of what had happened. The doctor was not a character in his own book. So he was writing a kind of dissertation. And I was a little bit dubious about it because I hadn't met him yet. So I made a trip to New York and I met him, and he was actually a larger than life character. He turned out to be a wonderful character for a movie just by chance. I mean, he could have been rather boring and maybe it wouldn't have worked out so good, but he was a very interesting character. So after that meeting, I saw a way of doing it.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about Schindler's List, because I know that so many people are incredible fans of the film, and the script is obviously one of the greatest of all time, in not just in my opinion, obviously.
Well, there was a book. Thomas Keneally wrote a very good book. And then I had the good fortune to have access to two of the survivors who are actually characters in the story, who lived in Los Angeles. They basically were very enthusiastic about the project. They really wanted to help. They told me their own personal experiences, which I could then extrapolate from that, really, you know, from what they were doing on a day-to-day basis, both in Krakow and in the camps. So they were the most important source of research.
Because originally it wasn't going to be a Steven Spielberg film. You were working with Marty Scorsese, is that right? How did that come about? And maybe you could tell people who might not know how the changeover between Scorsese and Spielberg occurred and what that experience was like.
Well, I don't really know what happened there because I wasn't part of that. But I got a call from somebody who worked with Scorsese. I'm not even sure how that happened.
Right.
De Niro was in Awakening, so, you know, maybe, I don't know, a conversation between them led to me somehow. I really don't know. But yes, he was the original director on it. And we worked together on a couple of drafts. You know, it was great. He is somebody who you just sit down with for 8 hours and kind of go over the script page by page and ideas come up. And it's a wonderful kind of experience. He also leaves you totally on your own, you know, to do whatever you want. and then starts making suggestions after the first draft is done. So that was really good. And by the way, I think most good directors do the same thing. You know, leave the writer alone to begin with, and then really get into the process of collaboration on the rewrites.
But then at a certain point, Steven Spielberg began working with you. At the time, as you were working with him on the script, did you have any sense what was going on? I mean, what was your perception at that moment, and how did it evolve? And ultimately, what was the experience of being in Poland and watching
that? Well, I think everybody's opinion of it was that this was Spielberg's, you know, kind of pet project, but it was never thought to be a commercial project. There was not a lot of pressure on us to deliver a commercial product, and I think that turned out to be really important. I felt that the only thing I wanted to do was do it well enough that, you know, I didn't like look bad. I was worried not so much if people would come see it, but if I could just sort of do a decent job. That was my goal. My goal didn't extend beyond the script. I didn't really think in terms of the film.
But I mean, the actual final film is remarkably dutiful to your script. I mean, give or take a couple of things. The reality is that even some of the cuts are actually in the script. I mean, Stephen was incredibly faithful to what you've written. And there's a famous story that at a certain point before he was going to shoot, he sent the script to a couple of esteemed writer friends, and the English writer Tom Stoppard. Steven Spielberg sent Schindler's List to him, and Tom Stoppard said, "Don't change a single word," which I think was something that you were grateful to stop up for.
Forever.
But what was that experience like being in Poland? Obviously, I mean, you know, it's such incredibly horrific events. It must have been a strange sensation to see this brought to life. In one sense, exhilarating because there it is coming to life in this incredible story. And in another, so real and horrific. What was that experience like?
Well, I went to Poland when I was doing research. But I was only there for like the first 10 days of shooting. And the reason was I was gearing up to do Searching for Bobby Fischer. And so I had to get back and start on that. Mm-hmm. Looking back on it, I'm really happy I did that, because when I saw the film, I was seeing a film that I didn't know, you know, it was a complete surprise to me. I don't think I saw any dailies during the 10 days either. Mm-hmm. It's a nice experience, and I actually prefer that. These days, I very seldom hang out on sets. I did early on, like with Penny on Awakenings, I was there a lot. After that, I just decided that my job is really done when I turn in the script. If a director's going to be faithful to it, or, you know, whatever they're going to do with it, they're going to do that whether I'm there or not.
But clearly you were incredibly pleased with the final result of the film, because...
Schindler?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think that what Spielberg did was amazing. I mean, he brought a kind of a visual approach to it that was stunning, I thought. You know, you say it's remarkably faithful to the script. It is, but every scene has to be interpreted visually, and he would do that with each scene in a really exciting way. Mm-hmm. I remember quite clearly in my original draft, the liquidation of the ghetto scene, which comes, I guess, about at the end of the first act. I think it was like 2 pages. And he wanted to make it a really big sequence. And it ended up being like 15 pages. Oh. On screen, I think it's like 20 minutes or something like that.
You'll be surprised by a great director.
Yeah, that they really bring something to the table that you would never think of.
And you mentioned Bobby Fischer. Now, how did that come about? And did the idea of directing had been something that had been with you for a long time, or was it inspired by reading this book?
It hadn't been with me. Most people think that writers are writing in order to become directors, and that directing is like the epitome of what we can do in this business. I never really felt that way. I really enjoyed writing the life of a writer. I felt that's what I was good at. I didn't aspire to be a director. However, it didn't go well with the director. And at that point, I thought, you know, maybe to protect my work, I was going to have to direct something. Mm. So it was an example of a bad experience leading to a good one. When I say put out the word, I talked to Scott Rudin, who by this time, we had started, he was 18, he was working for Edgar Sherrick. Now he was starting to produce movies. I told him about that, and he sent me kind of everything that he had or that he was interested in, books, articles, things like that. And one of them was Searching for Bobby Fischer, which was this little book with a photograph of this kid on it intently staring over a chessboard. He was basically 8 years old during this story when this book was written. And one of my sons was the same age. So I really related to it in terms of the story. Didn't play chess, my son, but the family story I could relate to.
And it began a great collaboration with Connie Hall, the incredible cameraman. So, yeah. I mean, what was that like, directing your first film and working with Connie?
Well, it was my first film, so I was very nervous, and I wasn't sure what a director was really supposed to do. And I felt I should know everything before I show up, or maybe somebody will ask me a question, I won't know the answer. So I basically storyboarded every shot for the movie. And Connie doesn't work that way. He'll do it, but he doesn't like it. So he retrained me to be more spontaneous. He said he couldn't even think about how to shoot it until he saw it. And the truth is, he didn't really read the script. I mean, he read it once, but, you know.
He liked the idea, chess.
It was okay, great, yeah. You know, it was a job. And he became totally into it by week three, I would say. It took about 3 weeks. And I became totally into his way of working, and it's the way I work now. In fact, on All the King's Men, I was working with another cinematographer because Connie had passed away. Pavel doesn't come from that school. He comes from the school of, you need to know what you're doing, you know? So I had to try to retrain him, and it was fun.
Shortly after finishing that, you then obviously were nominated for the Academy Award for your screenplay for Schindler's List and won. But after that, for those I'm sure who know, you win an Academy Award, and then you walk around and the press interviews you. And you told me the story that a lot of your father's kind of contemporaries as journalists were there interviewing Steve.
I mean, it was bittersweet because he had died a few years before then. But yeah, I mean, that was very special. You know, people always say write about what you know. I usually write about stuff I don't know about, because I like the process of learning about it. It's like when a European comes here, you know, to Austin, and they'll take pictures. The pictures they take are going to be different than the pictures that people from Austin take. You know, they're going to see it in a different way. For instance, like with Bobby Fischer, I wasn't interested in the chess world before, but when I started reading about it, it was kind of like a secret society, and it was something that I didn't know anything about, and I was learning about it. Awakenings, it was medicine. I don't know anything about medicine. Gangsters in the 1970s in New York, Harlem, I don't know anything about that. I would be bored writing about something that I know a lot about. I want to discover something.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Clayburgh Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. Generous support is also provided by the City of Austin Cultural Arts Division, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, the Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Our executive producer is Barbara Morgan, and the show is produced and edited by myself, Brian Ramos. I do the music for the show as well. Our associate producers are Aaron Halligan, Sonia Onescu, and Maya Perez. Our production coordinator is Katie Stewart, editing help from Jamal Knox. Production assistance from KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and conference in October. Until next time, I'm Brian Ramos, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.
PRI, Public Radio International.